In a world in which empire had followed empire, each greater than its predecessor, in a world through which men and ideas drove ever more loosely and freely, in a world visibly unifying even then, the Greeks, because of their peculiar physical and political circumstances, were still dreaming impossibly of a compact little city-state, impervious to outer influences, valiantly secure against the whole world. Plato's estimate of the number of citizens in a perfect state varied between 1,000 in the Republic and 5,040 in the Laws, citizens. This state was to go to war and hold its own against other cities of the same size, and this wasn't a couple of generations after the hosts of Xerxes had crossed the Hellespont. Perhaps these Greeks thought the day of world empires had passed forever, whereas it was only beginning. At the utmost, their minds reached out to alliances and leagues. There must have been men at the court of Artaxerxes thinking far away beyond these little ideas of the rocky creek, the island, and the mountain-encircled valley, but the need for unification against the greater powers that moved outside the Greek-speaking world, the Greek mind disregarded willfully. These outsiders were barbarians, not to be needlessly thought about. They were barred out now from Greece forever. One took Persian money. Everybody took Persian money. What did it matter? Or one enlisted for a time in their armies, as Xenophon did, and hoped for his luck with a rich prisoner. Athens took sides in Egyptian affairs and carried on minor wars with Persia, but there was no conception of a common policy or a common future for Greece. Until, at last, a voice in Athens began to shout, "Macedonia," to clamour like a watchdog, "Macedonia." This was the voice of the orator and demagogue Demosthenes, hurling warnings and threats and denunciations at King Philip of Macedon, who had learnt his politics not only from Plato and Aristotle, but also from Isocrates and Xenophon, and from Babylon and Susa, and who was preparing quietly, ably, and steadfastly to dominate all Greece, and through Greece to conquer the known world. There was a second thing that cramped the Greek mind, the institution of domestic slavery. Slavery was implicit in Greek life. Men could conceive of neither comfort nor dignity without it. But slavery shuts off one's sympathy not only from a class of one's fellow subjects. It puts the slave owner into a class and organization against all stranger men. One is of an elect tribe. Plato, carried by his clear reason and the noble sanity of his spirit beyond the things of the present, would have abolished slavery. Much popular feeling and the new comedy were against it. The Stoics and Epicureans, many of whom were slaves, condemned it as unnatural, but finding it too strong to upset, decided that it didn't affect the soul and might be ignored. With the wise, there was no bound or free. To the matter-of-fact Aristotle, and probably to most practical men, its abolition was inconceivable. So they declared that there were in the world men naturally slaves. Finally, the thought of the Greeks was hampered by a want of knowledge that's almost inconceivable to us today. They had no knowledge of the past of mankind at all. At best, they had a few shrewd guesses. They had no knowledge of geography beyond the range of the Mediterranean basin and the frontiers of Persia. We know far more today of what's going on in Susa, Persepolis, Babylon, and Memphis in the time of Pericles than he did. Their astronomical ideas were still in the state of rudimentary speculations. Anaxagoras, greatly daring, thought the sun and moon were vast globes, so vast that the sun was probably as big as all the Peloponnesus. Their ideas in physics and chemistry were the results of profound cogitation. It's wonderful that they did guess at atomic structure. One has to remember their extraordinary poverty in the matter of experimental apparatus. They had coloured glass for ornament, but no white glass. No accurate means of measuring the minor intervals of time. No really efficient numerical notation. No very accurate scale. No rudiments of telescope or microscope. A modern scientific man dumped down in the Athens of Pericles would have found the utmost difficulty in demonstrating the elements of his knowledge, however crudely, to the men he would have found there. He would have had to rig up the simplest apparatus under every disadvantage, while Socrates pointed out the absurdity of seeking truth with pieces of wood and string and metal, such as small boys use for fishing. And our professor of science would also have been in constant danger of a prosecution for impiety. Our world today draws upon relatively immense accumulations of knowledge, of fact. In the age of Pericles, scarcely the first stone of our comparatively tremendous cairn of things recorded and proved had been put in place. When we reflect upon this difference, then it ceases to be remarkable that the Greeks, with all their aptitude for political speculation, were blind to the insecurities of their civilization from without and from within, to the necessity for effective unification, to the swift rush of events that was to end for long ages these first brief freedoms of the human mind. It's not in the results it achieved, but in the attempts it made, that the true value for us of this group of Greek talkers and writers lies. It's not that they answered questions, but that they dared to ask them. Never before had man challenged his world and the way of life to which he found his birth had brought him. Never had he said before that he could alter his conditions. Tradition and a seeming necessity had held him to life as he had found it grown up about his tribe since time immemorial. Hitherto he had taken the world as children still take the homes and habits in which they've been reared. So in the 5th and 4th centuries BC we perceive most plainly in Judea and in Athens, but by no means confined to those centres, the beginnings of a moral and an intellectual process in mankind, an appeal to righteousness and an appeal to the truth from the passions and confusions and immediate appearance of existence. It's like the dawn of the sense of responsibility in a youth who suddenly discovers that life is neither easy nor aimless. Mankind is growing up. The rest of history for 3 and 20 centuries is threaded with the spreading out and development and interaction and the clearer and more effective statement of these main leading ideas. Slowly, more and more men apprehend the reality of human brotherhood, the needlessness of wars and cruelties and oppression, the possibilities of a common purpose for the whole of our kind. In every generation thereafter, there's the evidence of men seeking for that better order to which they feel our world must come. But everywhere and wherever in any man, the great constructive ideas have taken hold, the hot greeds, the jealousies, the suspicions, and impatience that are in the nature of every one of us, war against the struggle towards greater and broader purposes. The last 23 centuries of history are like the efforts of some impulsive, hasty immortal to think clearly and live rightly. Blunder follows blunder, promising beginnings end in grotesque disappointments. Streams of living water are poisoned by the cup that conveys them to the thirsty lips of mankind. But the hope of men rises again at last after every disaster. We pass on now to the story of one futile commencement, one glorious shattered beginning of human unity. There was in Alexander the Great knowledge and imagination, power and opportunity, folly, egotism, detestable vulgarity, and an immense promise broken by the accident of his early death while men were still dazzled by its immensity.